Morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around the world. Welcome to this episode 30 of DeveloPod, where we continue with, in fact, the final interview in the series of influencers and thought leaders in ELT. This time, we have Chia Xuan Chong, the prolific blogger, teacher and teacher trainer, who is together with Bashak. Now, Bashak is a teacher and teacher trainer herself, who won a competition last year to win a free IATEFL membership. And she is asking questions to Chia because she feels she is an inspiration. Hi, Bashak and Chia. Thank you so much both for joining us in the virtual studio, as it were.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for giving up your time. Bashak, can you tell us where you are?
I'm in Turkey, Eskişehir. It's a small city close to the capital, Ankara. And I live here, work here, like it here.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. My first teaching job abroad was actually in Ankara many years ago. Anyway, Chia, welcome and thanks so much for joining us. Where are you based?
I'm in York in the United Kingdom, not New York, the original York, which is about a four-hour drive from London, sort of midway point between London and Edinburgh. And I've been living in York for the last 7 years or so.
Beautiful. It's got a lovely cathedral, I hear. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. I'm a communication skills trainer, a teacher trainer, an intercultural skills trainer. And more recently, I've been spending most of my time as a freelance writer. I write ELT materials, I write communication skills materials, and I do lots of online teaching via webinars and interactive workshops. A lot of you might know me as the resident blogger for English Teaching Professional between the years of 2012 and 2019. I still write for their magazine, and I also wrote a book a year ago called Successful International Communication, where I focus mainly on helping our learners become better at communicating internationally, at intercultural skills and communication skills.
Super. We can provide that link with the show notes. So we're here to really unite both of you, and Bashak has been inspired by you. I'm sure she can talk about that a little more. And Bashak, here's your chance to ask Chia all the questions that you wanted to ask.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity. I have several questions, actually. The first one is about your blog post, The Imposter Syndrome. So have you ever suffered from the imposter syndrome yourself? And what did you do? Was there a particular suggestion in your blog post to help you?
Thanks, Bashak. First of all, thanks for choosing me to interview. I'm really, really honored. Before I talk about imposter syndrome, I think it's important to first define what imposter syndrome is for listeners who've never heard of the imposter syndrome. Basically, it's something that many of us have felt before, being in a job where we feel like we don't deserve to be in. It could be, you know, teaching a exam preparation class and feeling like you don't know enough about this exam to be the authority teaching it. Or it could be someone who's just been promoted from being a teacher to a DOS, a director of studies, and feeling like, oh, I can teach, but can I really manage 40 teachers? Many of us have been in that position where we've doubted our own ability and wondered if anyone's going to realize that we are an imposter after all, and that, you know, we don't deserve this job. So to answer your question, Basha, yes, many times in all those situations that I've mentioned, you know, being in an exam class and thinking, oh, this is the first time I'm teaching this exam class. Will the students realize that I know very little about this exam? I made the transition from being a general English teacher to a business English teacher early on in my career. And I often worried about the fact that I did not come from a business background. I didn't really have business experience. And a lot of my students have business experience in the corporate world or are in the corporate world. And I always worried that, you know, they might find me lacking in knowledge about their situations, their context, to be able to give them the business English that they needed. But I soon realized that, you know, there are ways of tackling these insecurities. And one way is to you know, once you're aware that you're insecure and you admit that you are insecure about it, one way is to actually go and learn something about it. You know, if you're insecure about teaching an engineering student, then, you know, go do some reading up about engineering, for example, and talk to experts from that field. So if you're worried about, you know, taking on a DOS role and not knowing enough about management and leadership, you know, take up some courses, some short courses, read up on the internet, talk to someone who you respect, a good manager or leader, and get tips from them. So I think, you know, if you approach it with an attitude of continuous professional development, an attitude of loving the learning of it, then I think we could turn this imposter syndrome into a good thing.
So you consider yourself as a sort of a learner of the new situation?
Yeah, I would like to think that, you know, I love learning, and I think a lot of teachers would probably feel the same.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can feel really insecure when you're learning about something that you know very little about. I remember when I started to drive at a very late stage of my life. I was 40 before I took my first driving lesson. And I felt really insecure. And I remember having this conversation with my husband, who said to me, "How many times at this stage of your life can you say that you're a true beginner at something? How many times can you say that you're really learning something from scratch?" So I said, "Oh, no, actually not many." So he said, "Well, enjoy the experience." And I thought that's a really good attitude to take on things. You know, if you don't know about something, instead of fretting about being insecure, embrace that insecurity and say, "Hey, I'm going to enjoy learning. Yeah, there's so much I can learn. This is going to be great."
I suppose that makes sense.
Bashak, can I ask you the same question? Have you ever felt the imposter syndrome?
Of course. I mean, like Chia said, I suppose everybody does at some point.
Exactly.
I had this idea that I will always be teaching, but then lately I became an ACT, Assistant Celta Trainer. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel like I had enough experience or, I don't know, a perspective to be one, especially considering the other trainers I've been around. So I didn't feel all that confident. So that's actually, I think, one of the reasons I looked up that blog post. Mm-hmm. It was also because I also became a parent. I didn't know how to juggle, like, being a mother, a teacher, and a new trainer, if you will. So I think that's why I wanted to ask that particular question myself.
I think you've mentioned some really, you know, good self trainers there who are really at the top of their game, right? You've got Danny Norrington Davis, who is amazing, Richard Chin, Ree, Jason Anderson, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the benefit of having such amazing tutors or role models is that obviously you can learn from them and you can try and emulate them. Yeah. But then there's always a negative side, and that negative side is that you start comparing yourself to them. And when they're so amazing, you start to think, you know, there is no way I could ever be like that. And that's where that self-doubt starts to set in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you've got to really remind yourself, you know, yes, there is a way you can be like that. And, you know, I think it would be better that you rather emulate yourself to be, you know, someone who is amazing rather than just, you know, try and copy someone who's just a little better than you. Like they say, you know, reach for the stars, and if you get to the moon, you know, it's not too bad.
Wonderful advice, yeah. So, yeah, be the best version of yourself and take them as inspiration, but you will develop as a Celta trainer. I know when I worked as a Celta trainer, I learned so much. I thought I know about teaching. And then I realized how it added clarity to my teaching as well as my training work. And that was the biggest learning experience for me, learning to be a Celta trainer. So go for it.
And yeah, learning about learning.
Exactly, exactly. And you're also there. You're in that position because you're ready for it. Remember that.
Taking notes.
Thank you. Whatever role we end up in, we are always on a journey. And so if you remember what it was like when we first started teaching in a classroom, we were nervous. We probably felt like we shouldn't be there in front of all these students. And over the years, you know, you learn to be a better teacher. You might teach the same lesson 10 times before you kind of get into the groove of knowing what you want to do with that lesson. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when then you move from one role to another, you know, you move from teaching general English to business English or to being a Celta tutor, Delta tutor, to becoming a manager. And each time you transition into a new role, you sort of start at that bottom part of it again. You know, you start that journey again, learning and getting better and learning more about the role. But, you know, one thing I love about our industry and our jobs is the fact that, you know, there's always somewhere to go. So, you know, you become a really amazing general English teacher, for example. It doesn't stop there. It doesn't mean that you stagnate, because you can move on to the next phase. You can become a really amazing IELTS teacher or CELTA trainer. You know, there's always somewhere to go. And I think that's what's so inspiring about this job.
Definitely, definitely. Can I ask another question?
Of course.
So considering your ideas about the intercultural communication, did you face any resistance about your ideas, about the need for the native speakers to learn to communicate with other speakers of English? Were there any resistance, maybe from among your colleagues or friends or other people around you?
Okay, so let's just break that question down, because there are two different things here.
Yeah.
One is intercultural communication, which unfortunately in a lot of ELT materials, when you talk about culture or mention intercultural communication, it often kind of stops at a very superficial level of, you know, talking about festivals and food and costumes and, you know,
tradition,
the population of Brazil, that sort of superficial level of facts and figures. But in actual fact, if you think about it, all of our students who are learning English so that they can talk to someone else from a different cultural background, right? It might not be a native speaker that they're speaking English to, but, you know, hey, if a Peruvian person speaks to a Turkish person, or if a Chinese person speaks to an Italian person, instantly it's intercultural communication, right? And we are so focused on teaching grammar, lexis, pronunciation, but we're forgetting that actually one of the biggest sources of communication breakdown, it's not really the grammar or the lexis or the pronunciation, as a lot of ELF researchers would say. It's actually that intercultural misunderstanding. You know, they do things differently from me. You know, I reply to emails on the same day. I've been waiting for an email from this guy for 5 days and he still hasn't replied. He's so he doesn't respect my time. And it's this like differences in how we do things, differences in how we communicate, that is what causes misunderstanding. And I've been advocating that, you know, teachers like us, we're not just teaching language, we're also teaching our students to be better communicators, better international communicators. So, you know, we have to go beyond teaching just grammar and lexis. We have to look at the soft skills involved. We have to look at intercultural communication, communication styles, how to deal with conflict, how different people deal with conflict, how different people build trust and rapport, you know, the interpersonal skills stuff as well. And yes, to your question, I have had resistance to that. As you can imagine, some teachers are like, no, you know, I'm a language teacher. That's not my field. And fair enough, I think, to those teachers, if that's what you want to specialize in, grammar, lexis, pronunciation, that's perfectly fine. I'm not saying that that's bad. But from my experience, when I deal with intercultural communication, interpersonal skills, I find that students, my students, benefit greatly from it. And they're also getting language practice. They're getting both. I feel good about the fact that I'm helping them become better communicators and not just better English speakers, if that makes sense. So that's one part of that question. So the other part of your question was about native speakers and my claim, I say claim, that native speakers also need to improve the way they communicate. I wrote a blog post for ETP several years ago, which won blog post of the month, and it was circulated. It went a bit viral, and I got some really interesting feedback, shall I say.
Interesting.
Some people were really happy to read this blog post where I said native speakers need to learn to become better international communicators. a lot of people felt relieved to know that just because you're a native speaker of English does not make you an amazing communicator. And I think we can be in agreement about that, right? There are lots of native speakers of English who aren't necessarily good communicators, because as I said earlier, communication skills are a slightly different skill set, and it's not just language skills we're talking about. Of course, then there are people who find that offensive. You know, how dare you say that, you know, how dare you say that I need to learn English? And I find myself clarifying this time and time again with people saying, I'm not saying they have to learn English. I'm not saying they have to improve their English. All I'm saying is they can't rest on their laurels and just take it for granted that just because they're native speakers, they're going to be fine communicating internationally. Because very often in an international situation, you find that non-native speakers find native speakers intimidating when they come in with their cultural references, or they come in with their, you know, localized idioms and nobody else seems to understand them. I can imagine people getting very angry with me just saying that already. But I think, you know, teachers might have a certain reaction to this, but I've done courses and I've presented workshops and seminars to native speakers in several industries. Recently, I went to a firefighters conference, for example, and I spoke to the, you know, people who were top of their game in the firefighting industry. And they really related to what I was saying, because a lot of the time the firefighters on the ground have to speak to people in local communities that might not have amazing English. They might live in England, but they might belong to certain local communities where English is not their first language. And so one option is for the firefighter to say, well, you're my country, speak my language, or I'll just leave your house to burn. Or I just won't call the ambulance because I don't know what you're saying to me. They could take that route, or they could say, hey, you know, at the end of the day, saving lives is what matters. And in a life or death situation, if I have to tell a concert hall of 1,000 people to evacuate, I have to remember that not all of them can understand my English. I have to think about other communication styles. I have to think about other ways of letting those people know that they need to evacuate immediately. And these firefighters that I spoke to really related to that, and they were extremely interested in the course and in sending their employees, their firefighters, to such a course, because we know that at the end of the day, good communication, effective communication, is not about pride or ego. At the end of the day, it's about getting that message across no matter how. And if you can get your message across successfully and effectively, whether you're a native or non-native speaker, that's what you're aiming for.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you feel like you have less resistance now?
There will always be people who say, you know, what rubbish. I remember when I wrote that blog post, some people even said, who gave her her MA? Take her MA off her. I think there will always be people that react in that way. It is a controversial subject, but I think if we think carefully about, you know, the main message here, it is not a message of criticizing native or non-native speakers. It's simply saying, if we want to communicate internationally, whatever your background, we need to improve those communication skills. That's it, really.
I was just going to say, I think the issue might come down to, as you say, ego, but also feelings of ownership. And ultimately, no one owns any language, and certainly not English.
Totally, totally. I think there are lots of factors at play here. You know, there was this, maybe you could enlighten me. There was this football coach who went to, I believe it was Holland.
I'm afraid football is definitely not my subject.
If you go on YouTube, you'll probably find a clip. Basically, he's English and he went to Holland to be a coach to a football team in Holland and gives an interview to, I think, the BBC or one of the British media channels. And people noticed that his accent, his English accent, had changed ever so slightly, that he was speaking in a way that an English person would find strange. And what he was actually doing was, because of the time he spent in Holland, he's learned to accommodate his pronunciation, vocabulary, the way he chunks his sentences so that his footballers can understand what he's saying. And obviously, when they interviewed him, he still had remnants of that adaptation. And the English football fans and people who didn't understand communication really laid into him. They criticized him for having a pretentious Dutch accent. They criticized him for forgetting his English accent. They criticized him for being fake. And I really felt for him, because what he had done there was actually a good thing. He had shown that he was a successful international communicator. He'd shown his ability to accommodate and adapt, and yet he was criticized because he wasn't so-called true to himself. So that begs the question, what do you mean by being true to yourself? Is it using the same accent and the same speech patterns no matter who you speak to? Because to me, that is the sign of a not very good communicator.
Well, I think as soon as we learn another language, we realize that we could be many things and many personas through many languages. And actually, we change a little bit through learning another language. And personally, my English has changed through teaching. And sometimes actually people think I'm either French or Danish or occasionally South African. I know my vowel sounds have changed, for example. And I think all of us as teachers, whether native, non-native, or some other term that we'd like to find, whoever we are as teachers, we change and adapt according to who's listening. And we're very good at that generally. I think it's other people who could learn those skills of intercultural communication, as well as teachers, of course. Yeah, we can continue to learn.
I think, you know, that's a really good point. And on that note, we could actually think about not the fact that native speakers are the ones that need to improve their communication skills, but to be a bit more specific, native speakers who have never learned another language, mm-hmm. never communicated internationally, who have lived in a bit of a bubble.
Yep.
They are the ones who might really need to think about how they speak to people from different countries if they're doing it for the first time, for example, and how they can adjust their speed of speaking, for example. Teachers do it so naturally because we've become used to doing it. So native speaker teachers, you know, over years of teaching, have learned to grade the language.
Yeah.
But I think the monolingual British person, for example, who hasn't been out of the country much except for holidays, might have a bit more issues with grading language than, say, an English teacher.
Sure.
But I think we kind of covered my next question about your suggestions to other trainers who hope to create similar changes in their institutions. It's not only about being non-native or native speaker, but it's about the understanding that it's just about communicating with other people, no matter what their background is, no?
I think there's still a lot of prejudice out there in teaching institutions that still advertise for native speaker only teachers. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's been a teacher, you know, an ELT teacher would know that being a native speaker teacher doesn't automatically make you a good teacher. If you're a native speaker teacher who's just, you know, who's taken a weekend course in teaching English and, you know, dived into teaching English simply because you spoke English as a first language, I strongly doubt that you'll be as good a teacher as someone, say, from Turkey who had spent years doing a master's degree in English language and years perfecting the art of teaching students whose problems they understand. So I think anyone who's been teaching would know this, but unfortunately, there's still some prejudice out there that teachers, especially non-native speaker teachers, are having to fight. And I can only say, keep fighting and know that you're good. You are good enough. You don't need to be a native speaker to teach English. And if anything, your non-native speaker status gives you more knowledge about your students' struggles and their difficulties. And it gives you more mm-hmm. knowledge about the intercultural communication aspect as well. So take pride in that.
You know, I would say we have certain strengths as well, because we understand what our learners go through. So as long as we acknowledge the strengths and weaknesses of these teachers, native versus non-native, I think we should be fine. We should maybe learn from each other.
Yeah, and I think, you know, see it as a challenge, perhaps, if you meet any resistance. You see, I consider myself a native speaker because I grew up speaking English. I was educated through the medium of English because I come from Singapore. But, you know, my name, my appearance doesn't look like a typical native speaker. And, you know, I taught English in London for about 10 years. And at the beginning, especially, I had students walking out of my class just after looking at my face. Literally, I had a student who walked in and walked out and went straight for the director of studies to say something to the extent of, I didn't come all the way to England to be taught by someone who looks like that. And thankfully, the director of studies took my side and said to her, go back to class immediately. I'm not having any of that. She's a really good teacher. She came and sat in my class for the day. And then the next morning, she went back to the director of studies and said, thank you for asking me to get back in there. That was an amazing lesson. And ever since that experience, I started to take these challenges as challenges. I might have to work a bit harder to prove to my students that I have a place in this classroom, that they are going to have a wicked lesson with me. And that might, you know, push me a little more to work harder. And I see that's a good thing. Why not? You know, if it improves my teaching, hey.
All the better for it. I would say yes. The prejudice is definitely here. Well, I teach in Turkey, and some of my students and some of my fellow colleagues sometimes, well, we talk about this issue, and some students say, well, my friend in blah blah class has a native speaker and it's a disadvantage to me. Well, I say, okay, thank you very much. But then again, like Chia said, we consider it as, I suppose, an opportunity. And it so happens sometimes it's just the other way around. A student comes to me and say, well, we have a native speaker and I don't understand a word he or she's saying. Mm. And so, like I said, it's about knowing, I think, acknowledging our strengths and weaknesses and, well, you know, figuring out a way to address to our students a little bit better, yeah. I suppose.
It's also about raising their awareness of the issue and maybe raising... I don't blame the students for saying they want a native speaker teacher, because we're talking about a history of language learning, of decades of believing in this, right? And of course, you know, if you ask anyone, if you're going to learn Portuguese, do you want someone who speaks Portuguese as a first language, or do you want someone who learned Portuguese when they're an adult? And very likely they're going to say, oh, I want a Portuguese native speaker. And you know, that sort of ingrained in us that, oh, if that person speaks as a first language, then they naturally know the language and they're going to be very good at that, forgetting that teaching skills are also involved. And I think it's about educating those people, making them aware, making them realize that, hey, actually, you know, there are other things that are important in making a good teacher, and being native or not native is really the least of your problems.
Bashak, I believe you had another question.
Yes. It's a bunch of questions about you being a mother on top of all things. So how did motherhood change the way you see yourself as a teacher or a trainer? And I imagine you have a support system, but did you struggle at all as a new mother, a teacher, a trainer? And how did parenthood agree with you being such an active figure? You mentioned seminars, webinars, and all that stuff. And how can you find a work-life balance?
I don't. Wow. Thank you for your confidence in my ability to juggle all those different roles that you mentioned. I'm not so sure about that ability myself. That's the imposter syndrome talking, probably. But yes, I think being a mum would change anyone, and it's a challenging role. You know, you go from a world where you're the center of your universe to a world where you are no longer the center of your universe and everything revolves around another human being for the first time in your life. And I know it sounds really selfish, but that's the fact of it, right? We live our lives being rather selfish, looking after our own interests, you know, our own hobbies, our own free time, our own work-life balance. And then suddenly a little human being comes along and then, you know,
your time is not your own.
Your time is not yours anymore. I'm quite lucky in that I was able to move and transition from working in a face-to-face training situation to a more freelance, you know, choose my own working hours kind of situation. And I think that really helps as a parent juggling work and parenthood. So, you know, if you're doing face-to-face training in a language school, for example, it's very likely that you're teaching Mondays to Fridays. And that just wasn't really feasible, you know, with kids. And you talked about support system. I don't really have a support system except my husband, because we live in York, away from both sets of parents. You know, and that's the other thing about modern life is, you know, we move around to different countries. We are very often separated from our immediate family. So, you know, we are very much on our own juggling. And thankfully, he's able to support me so that I could say, look, I need to go to this country for a conference, or I need to do this webinar at 3 o'clock next week. He tries his best to shift things around so that he can, you know, hold on to the kids for a little bit longer. It's been tough because we are now currently in a lockdown because of the whole coronavirus pandemic. And it's been constant, you know, trying to homeschool the children. And then he takes over at lunchtime and I try to get some work in at lunchtime. And then I take over the children again. And then when we put them to bed, I'm trying to work in the evenings and the weekends. So I find like my work-life balance has been quite bad lately. But one thing I have to say is I try to give my kids a schedule, and I try to stick to it. Not madly, not obsessively, but I try to stick to it. And I find that helps all of us to know what's coming up next. I also try to give them responsibilities. So I make the 4 and 6 year old look after the 1 year old for an hour every day so that I can get an extra hour of work. And it teaches them something, I'd like to think, you know. I get them to help me with the housework, and I try to make it more about teamwork than about, you know, me serving them. My favorite sentence is, I'm not your servant, do it yourself. So I guess, you know, that's how we try our best to manage in such a situation. The other thing I am very adamant about is putting them to bed at a sensible hour. I need that me time, as selfish as it may sound. I need that me time in the evenings after they've gone to bed to kind of either catch up on my work or just chill out and watch some television.
I'd just like to follow up the question there from Bashak. Did motherhood change the way you see yourself as a teacher in some way?
That's a good question. Yes and no. You know, I started to think about my level of patience a lot more. I think, you know, when you are teaching and you're in a classroom, I don't know if you would agree with me, Bashak, but I find it easier to have a certain level of patience with my students and to be like, yeah, mistakes are good, well done, you know, growth mindset and all that. And then when it comes to your own kids, I don't know, I find that I'm stricter, I have less patience with my own children, and maybe it's because it's 24/7, maybe it's because I need to work on that probably, but it might be the same thing with the kids. You know, kids often behave better when they're at school with their teacher in class than they are with their parents, because they play up, don't they? And I find that tough as well, and I often find myself saying, and these days when I'm homeschooling them during the lockdown, I find myself saying things like, would you do that for Miss Graham in your class? Would you do that in PE? Would you like lie on the couch when you're having PE?
One of the things about parenting, I think I find myself a little bit more tolerant in the classroom. I think I used to feel a lot more frustrated in the classroom, especially with students who actually don't want to be there. Now I think I can manage a little bit more. I don't know. What's it called? I don't think I'm patient. I think I'm very impatient on the inside.
On the inside. But that is good emotional intelligence, that ability to control it so that it's only on the inside. I wonder, just extrapolating from what you were saying, I feel like I'm better able to consider people's full circumstances. You know how when before you're a parent and you see a kid screaming in a supermarket and you're so quick to make that judgment on the parent. After you become a parent, you realize that, you know, really there's no such thing as good kids or bad kids. Kids are kids. And if you see them screaming at a supermarket, you're just seeing that 5 minute window of their behavior. They might be, you know, they might be angels for the rest of the day, but you might have just so happened to catch them at that worst point of the day when they were tired and screaming and ratty. And I think when I look at students as well, I think I'm less quick to make judgments like, oh, look at this student, always late, or they're not always not paying attention, always looking at their phone, or whatever judgments and irritations you might have with students, I think I'm more able to take a step back and consider their full circumstances. Maybe they're on the phone all the time, maybe because they're messaging a sick parent. Maybe they're late all the time because they're juggling two jobs to support the family. And I think I'm less quick to make a judgment from a teacher's point of view and take a step away from being a teacher and to look at them as a fellow human being and say, hey, you know, we're not getting the full picture. This is just a window that we're getting into their lives. You know, if they come to class for 1 hour a week, we only see them for that 1 hour window.
I think I know what you mean. The first day I left my daughter to daycare, it was all a bunch of emotions going around, and I was in class and I was thinking, okay, I left my kid in somebody else's hands and these are somebody's kids too. So, you know, now I can do what I can here and I hope that somebody else does the same for my kid.
Oh, that's a really lovely.
I don't think I had that before I, you know, became a mother.
I totally get you.
And about what you just said about the crying out kid and the parent in the shopping mall. Before I was a mother, I think I used to look at the kid and say, oh, and now I look at the parent and say, it'll pass.
Yes, absolutely. I think it makes us hopefully more understanding and more compassionate human beings. We feel sort of, I don't know, united by that knowledge.
Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. I love being able to talk to you and thank you for arranging it.
It's been really, really beautiful to witness two mothers speaking about various things, including teaching. And I wish you all the best, both of you, with not only your ongoing careers, but your parenthood and enjoying that, I guess.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Thanks, Masha, for all your questions and for connecting with me. I hope that we'll continue to have conversations like that.
Wasn't that a wonderful opportunity? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Başak, how do you say good luck in Turkish?
İyi şanslar.
İyi şanslar.
So thank you, listeners, for joining us today, and we hope you found the episode very interesting. And if you are inspired to delve a little bit deeper, then look at the show notes, where we include the references that Chia and Başak made to various articles and blog posts. If you are perhaps inspired by someone else in the ELT field, we'd very much encourage you to get in touch with us and perhaps we can set up an interview. You can also suggest any other topic. We'd really love to hear from you, so just do a search on TDSIG on either Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. In the meantime, do subscribe to our podcast and get it delivered straight to your platform of choice. So have a great month, take care, and hope to see you soon.